restructure governance so the faculty and the Senate are excluded from any aspect of governance. They've already been excluded from the disciplinary process. You have a bunch of kangaroo courts led by faceless, nameless bureaucrats, investigators who know nothing about education, and who have condemned student after student, faculty member after faculty member on ridiculous, spurious grounds. In some cases, kicking them out of the university. In the case of one of my colleagues, she was forced to leave her position at the law school. In the case of students, withdrawing or preventing them from getting their degrees, or suspending them for 2 years, including suspension of their funding. So we are talking about a situation in which really Columbia University has accepted a set of values that have nothing to do with the values that Chipman talked about. They're values that are dear to a dictatorship. There are values that are dear to censors. There are values that are dear to people who want to protect Israel from criticism at all costs while it slaughters people by the hundreds daily in Gaza. One child every day over more than 600. I mean, it's extraordinary. The largest number of children killed in a conflict, the largest number of medical workers killed in a conflict, the largest number of journalists killed in a conflict in the 21st century. And they want to protect that with IHRA, with their monitor, with their vice provost, with their kangaroo court disciplinary procedures. I don't see how people can, in good conscience, continue as before inside these universities. People really have to do something. It was easy for me. I'm retired. I simply decided not to teach a course that I didn't have to teach in any case. But it'll be harder, obviously, for people who depend on their salaries, for people whose careers would be affected. But I really do think that things have gotten to the point where people have to stand up and do more than any of us have done. I mean, people have tried to stop this genocide. The students were enormously heroic. Hundreds of them have paid very high prices in terms of expulsion, suspension, traumatic disciplinary procedures. Many of the students I know have been very severely psychologically harmed by the brutality of Columbia's crushing repression. They've sacrificed. I think it's time for other people to sacrifice. And by that, I don't just mean people in academia. I mean everybody. People in the complicit news media. The mainstream news media are complicit in genocide by, for example, publishing anything that the Israeli military spokesman says. They're inveterate liars. They should be called out for that. When it is proven that what they're saying is an absolute lie, the media should be saying that. On the contrary, the reverence for anything an Israeli official says is nauseating. These people are committing genocide. You would not have reverence for the government of Myanmar or for the rapid support forces in Sudan as they slaughter people. Why are we reverently repeating in the media the lying statements of Israeli officials? There's a lot more that needs to be done by everybody.
I wanted to get your response. I've seen this going around online that there's going to be a spontaneous memorial for the first concrete academic casualty post-deal, in parentheses, Khalidi's class outside the campus on Broadway north of 116th at noon today. Your thoughts on this?
I hadn't heard about that. One of the things that I mentioned in the article that I wrote for The Guardian was that I will be teaching a free hybrid short course on Palestine, which will summarize a chunk, but not all, of what I was going to teach in this course at Columbia. I'll be doing that in New York at the People's Forum, time and date and details yet to be arranged. So I will be teaching this fall, but not at Columbia. And I will continue to teach elsewhere. Maybe not in the halls of corrupt academia, maybe elsewhere. I think it's a little early for a postmortem.
Professor Khalidi, I want to get your response to the latest developments in Gaza. At least 6 more Palestinians have starved to death there in the past 24 hours as famine spreads. At least 181 Palestinians, including 94 kids, have now died from hunger-related causes in Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli forces killed at least 92 Palestinians Sunday, including 56 who died seeking food. Another 34 Palestinians have been killed so far today. And yesterday on Sunday, an Israeli strike hit the headquarters of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society in Khan Yunis, destroying the facilities, one staff member killed. Can you respond, Professor Halady, to what's happening there now? The emaciated video of hostages coming out, yet 10,000 Israelis protesting in Tel Aviv, demanding a ceasefire, demanding an end to Israel's war on Gaza.
I wish nobody were starving in Gaza, but the cause of that is Israel's war on Gaza, including the starvation of the hostages, if in fact they're starving. And that's enabled by the United States. The United States put up the money for these killing fields called an international humanitarian, whatever they call it, where hundreds of people are killed every single day. And only people who are young and able, and there are not that many left in Gaza, are even able to access these sites. The United States is responsible for this. We, Americans, should be protesting this. The bombs that they dropped on the Red Crescent headquarters, in which one staffer was killed, are American bombs. They have bombed every single hospital in Gaza at least once, and some of them have been completely destroyed. They've destroyed every single university in Gaza. They've destroyed water treatment plants. They've destroyed sewage treatment plants. This is genocide. And this is American facilitated, supported, financed genocide. The Israelis should stop the war. The Israeli people should rise up. But it is Americans who have to rise up. It is our war. It is our money. These are our bombs. These are our bullets. Every single warplane in the Israeli arsenal is American. F-35, F-15, F-16. Every single combat helicopter is American. They do not do what they're doing without the United States holding them up. And we must stop this. The specifics of the massacres of people at these so-called humanitarian aid centers are an American initiative. The United States is enabling Israel to slaughter people seeking food in a situation where Israel is systematically starving. I think my reaction is we have to do more. We are responsible. The United States government and people are responsible. And to their credit, most Americans have now woken up. Support for Israel is at the lowest point that it's ever been in the entire history of the Zionist project or of the state of Israel. A majority of Americans oppose Israel's war on Gaza, including growing numbers even of Republicans. It's time for Americans to stand up and force the Trump administration and force the craven cowards in our Congress to do something to stop this. To their credit, 27 Democratic senators voted to stop arms aid to Israel. Much, much more has to be done by all of us.
Professor Halady, the Halidys are one of the most prominent families on the West Bank. I wanted to ask you about what's going on there. Israeli authorities are continuing to refuse to release the body of the Palestinian activist Oda Havalin, who was fatally shot by an Israeli settler last Monday in the occupied West Bank. Israel's also still detaining 7 members of his family, 60 Palestinian women from the village of Al-Khayr began a hunger strike Thursday to demand justice. On Sunday, Israelis held demonstrations in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem to protest Oda's killing and also the withholding of his body, the young man who worked on the Oscar-winning film No Other Land. Meanwhile, Israeli authorities have released the settler accused of killing Havalin, Inon Levy. He'd been under house arrest. Earlier this year, the Trump administration lifted the Biden-era sanctions on him. Your response?
All of this is par for the course. The Israelis have imposed conditions for this poor man's family to hold a funeral. They're not allowed to bury him in his home village. They're not allowed to have a public mourning for him. And this is what they do all the time. They're holding the bodies of hundreds of Palestinians whom they've refused to return to their families. Alleged, quote unquote, terrorists, people who have been engaged in resistance, and others who've done nothing. And so this is par for the course. There is a jackboot military dictatorship in a country that claims that half the population under its control have no rights, but claims that it's a democracy. What kind of democracy is it when half of its subjects have absolutely no rights, are subject to this kind of treatment, murdered by settlers. The settler who murders them goes free. The body of the victim is held in a refrigerator somewhere. It's typical of the way in which this institution operates. You have ministers. I mean, our family is actually from Jerusalem. And you had a senior minister go up to the Haram al-Sharif and lead public prayers of several thousand. Apparently, he was with several thousand other Israeli extremists, leading public prayers in an area which never, in which that was never, never allowed under any regime, including the Israeli military occupation previously. This was never, never acceptable. Imagine people going into a synagogue or a church and having Muslim prayers. Imagine. And this is what Ben-Gvir, senior minister in this government, in fact, one of the most important figures in the whole Israeli government, did the other day on the Tisha B'Av, the ninth of the date on which Herod's temple was destroyed by the Romans. So this is typical of the absolute trampling on Palestinian rights all over Palestine, whether we're talking about people actually being subject to starvation and death in Gaza, or whether we're talking about people driven out of their homes in Jenin refugee camps in the southern part of the West Bank, or in Jerusalem, or we're talking about this kind of ridiculous arbitrary detention. Imagine a man is killed, they won't let the family hold a funeral, and they arrest members of his family, and the perpetrator goes free. Because he's a distinguished figure in the settler movement, which dominates this government. I mean, it's time for people to wake up and realize that this crystal ideal vision of Israel is a lie. It is a systematically developed, systematically built up lie. This is a state that has deprived an entire people of its national rights for generations. This is a state that is built on theft of other people's property, their land, their property, their books. Books of everybody in the cities that were conquered in 1948 were taken and are now in the Israeli Library, National Library. We're talking about a theft on a scale, on a vast scale, going back decades and decades and decades. And you can see videos that Israeli soldiers post of them stealing things from Palestinian homes in Gaza to this day. So I think it's time for people to wake up. I think it's time for this idealized vision of Israel to shatter, and for people to come to terms with the fact that we are funding and financing this ethnic cleansing, this genocide, this theft day by day by day of people's land in the West Bank.
Professor Halady, I wanted to get your response to this protest that took place on Friday. Democracy Now! Was there.
I'm Mimi Goodman. This is Democracy Now! We're standing outside the offices of New York Senators Kirsten Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer. Jewish Voice for Peace has shut down this office building. A number of people are getting arrested inside. Others are about to be arrested. Among them, New York State Assembly member Claire Valdez of Queens and New York City Council member Tiffany Caban. Also protesting are the actor Sara Ramirez of Sex and the City and other TV shows, as well as well over 100 people, Jews and their supporters. Their T-shirts say, "Stop arming Israel and stop starving Gaza." Unconscionable for anyone to stand by
perpetrated on innocent people. We're seeing a human-made famine unfold in Gaza that we've been warning about for years and months now. We need to let aid in as soon as possible. We need to stop funding a village life in Gaza. The senators in New York State are complicit in that. They do not stand up against it. That's why I'm here.
Was New York State Assembly member Claire Valdez and New York City Council member Tiffany Caban. They both were arrested with around 50 other Jewish protesters and their allies in an event that was a protest that was sponsored by Jewish Voice for Peace. Among the people who were protesting were Sex and the City's Sarah Ramirez and many others. As we wrap up, Professor Holliday, your response to the responses. You just talked about the polls lowest ever in support of Israel. What needs to happen here in the U.S.?
American politicians need to realize that the people oppose their policies of unlimited support for Israel. It's about time that the people who are elected by the people respond to the demand that's coming up from almost every sector of American society. Stop this blind support for Israel. End this genocide. The United States can end it. And it is their responsibility to do it, or they will face a reckoning, because people are not going to support representatives who simply do not represent them on this issue that everybody realizes is of enormous moral significance. They should wake up and do the right thing for a change. And I'm happy to see that some of them have done that. A couple of them were at this protest. Some senators did the right thing the other day. Many, many more need to do the right thing, or they will be tossed out of office and will deserve to be tossed out of office by angry constituents, not physically voted out at the polls.
Rashid Khalidi, Edward Said, Professor Emeritus of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including The 100 Years War on Palestine. We'll link to your piece in The Guardian. I spent decades at Columbia. I'm withdrawing my fall course due to its deal with Trump. He was speaking to us from France. When we come back, a ProPublica investigation reveals how hundreds of Venezuelan men deported to El Salvador from the U.S., then released to Venezuela by the Trump administration, say they endured months of physical and mental abuse inside CECAT. Back in 20 seconds.
Soy el terreno. Naturaleza robada, soy pensamiento indebido, grito de voz silenciada, soy el dolor.
Baile, performed in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Now that they're free, that's the headline of a new joint investigation that reveals how the hundreds of Venezuelan men deported by the Trump administration to El Salvador, then sent to Venezuela, say they endured months of physical and mental abuse inside the Salvadoran mega prison CECAT. Though happy to be home in Venezuela, they say the fact that they were released is proof of how senseless their detentions were. The report is the work of reporters from ProPublica, the Texas Tribune, and a team of Venezuelan journalists from Rebel Alliance Investigates and Fake News Hunters. In a minute, we'll be joined by one of the reporters. But first, we turn to their video of three Venezuelan men who were held in El Salvador, now home in Venezuela.
My name is Andre Omar Blanco Bonilla.
My name is Wilmer Jose Vega Sandia.
My name is Juan Jose Ramos Ramo.
In their own words, the nightmare at CECAT.
When we landed in El Salvador, I was by a window and I saw thousands, thousands of officers around the planes.
Fear, 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 terror.
An officer from El Salvador got on board and he said, either you get off the easy way or the hard way. How will you get off? We're not getting off. Oh, the hard way then. And they started hitting us with batons.
The prison director told us, welcome to hell, where you enter alive and leave dead.
They forced us to kneel against our will, beating us. There were many people screaming, asking for help, for mercy. The shackles were so tight, and they injured our ankles. Many were even bleeding because we were cutting ourselves with the shackles. They would say to us crudely, walk, you piece of... I remember telling an officer, I can't walk. If you loosen the shackles, I can cooperate, but I can't walk. I have a medical condition. I'm hypertensive. I was beaten to the point of fainting. They dragged me until we got to the cell block. Then they threw me down. My head hit the floor. I woke up and asked God, why am I here?
I felt like my world had collapsed. They started putting 10 to 15 people in each cell.
I believe the Seco prison is not a prison meant to hold inmates. There, I feel like we were treated like animals.
Food tastes like soap. It was shocking. The bathrooms were disgusting. They used the water we had to use the shower.
Las cloacas, cañerías de aguas negras.
Sewage black water pipes ran through the cells. Some people developed respiratory illnesses because of that. The walls were full of mold.
Sleeping on metal because the beds were iron. I said, how long are we going to survive this? How long are we going to endure it? 15 minutes for 10 people to shower.
Some didn't get to shower because time ran out. The price of good hygiene was a beating.
I tried to bathe secretly and they saw me. They dragged me to the wall, the island, and started beating me. And one officer kept hitting me on the ears as if to disorient me. And then on the temple, right here, they beat me for nearly 2 hours. Every guard on duty would take turns hitting you. Even the prison director hit us many times. I couldn't see well out of one eye because of the beatings to the head.
They took us to solitary confinement. They called it the hole. I got hit in my private parts, you could say. From a kick I received, I am still suffering from it. On April 5th, there was a major beating where they beat one of our fellow inmates who was a kid. They pepper sprayed into his mouth and he started convulsing on the floor. He was foaming at the mouth. They told us he had died, but thank God he is alive. He came back to us. When the Red Cross came for the first time, we spoke out, but speaking out cost us a brutal beating.
They used weapons, firing rubber and plastic pellets, and many were injured. Injuries to the head, forehead, legs, back, chest.
Many of us tried to take our own lives in there. We said, I'd rather die or kill myself than keep living through this experience. Waking every day at 4 a.m. to insults and beatings, listening to the clanging of metal bars, hearing your brothers get beaten, crying for help. They'd plead, please stop hitting me. I'd rather you kill me.
I don't deny that I used to support President Nayib Bukele's policies to fight crime. I never imagined that I would one day experience this injustice myself. It has been a dirty policy. The United States sent us to El Salvador so that El Salvador could do the dirty work that the U.S. couldn't. And justice will only come through the truths and testimonies of each of us.
part of a video report that accompanies a new investigation headline, Now That They're Free. For more, we're joined by one of the lead reporters, Perla Treviso. She's with ProPublica, Texas Tribune Investigative Unit, joining us from Philadelphia. Perla, welcome back to Democracy Now! As we just listened to these three men, their horrifying stories, you write about another man, Leonardo Jose Colmenares Solorzano, a 31-year-old Venezuelan who told you that now that he's free, he wants the world to know he was tortured over 4 months in a Salvadoran prison. He said guards stomped on his hands, poured filthy water into his ears, and threatened to beat him if he didn't kneel alongside other inmates and lick their backs. Tell us more about this investigation, how you reached these men in Venezuela, and what they're saying today, and what this says about what the U.S. did, arresting well over 200 Venezuelans, sending them to Salvador to be put in SECOT, and then making a deal with a so-called prisoner swap, and then just releasing them to Venezuela.
Yes, well, first of all, thank you for having me. These men were sent to El Salvador on March 15. From that day on, we started gathering as much information as we could about them. We started reaching out to families. Then when CBS News published a list of the names, we started compiling this database. We wanted to know who these men are. The administration was portraying them as the worst of the worst, violent criminals who deserve to be there. And we wanted to, you know, learn a little bit more about them. In total, we reached out to more than 100 family members and lawyers for this man. We combed records in the U.S., in Venezuela, Chile, Peru, Colombia. And the men that you just saw right now, you know, we had been in touch with their families for months at this point, and the conversations were very much about the void that they had left behind. You know, they were wondering where they're alive. One mom was telling me, you know, when I asked her what you think about, it's like, you know, is he eating? Is he sleeping? Is he alive? Because the administration at that point had not confirmed, and even up to this point, they had not, you know, they have not provided an official list of who was sent to El Salvador. So by the time that they were released, that they were free, we had been building relationship with these moms. And, you know, there's dozens, hundreds of stories that we could have told. And these are just three of the examples that we thought, you know, provided exemplified what the broader group had lived through.
Of the more than 230 men who were sent to Venezuela, you discovered at least 197 had not been convicted of crimes in the U.S., and that the Trump administration was aware of this. As President Trump was saying, we're going after the worst of the worst, the rapists and the murderers. Perla.
Yeah, so we obtained, you know, in addition to the background information that I described, we also obtained internal government record that showed how the government itself was labeling them, whether they had criminal convictions in the U.S., whether they had pending charges, or they were deemed immigration violators, meaning they had only violated immigration laws. And so not only does this match what others had reported, but it shows that the administration itself knew, even when they were portraying them as the violent criminals that deserved to be sent to a prison in the country that was not their own, potentially indefinitely, they actually knew that the vast majority did not have convictions in the U.S. And we found that, you know, from those six, you know, half a dozen of them had convictions for what would be deemed violent crimes.
You also write that the State Department said it's not responsible for the conditions of the place where the U.S. sent the men to. You had Bukele saying the U.S. is in charge. And, of course, you had President Trump saying that Bukele was in charge. Perla, your final comment.
You know, I think this is part of the issue that experts, advocates, lawyers point out to. When you push a border enforcement detention out, who is responsible at the end for what happens to the in this case, these men who were detained? I think everyone, by the U.S. pushing into El Salvador, it says whatever happens in El Salvador is not our issue. El Salvador is saying, well, you know, it's still under the jurisdiction of the U.S. So at the end, who is accountable for any human rights violations that the men alleged occur while they were in detention for months.
Perla Treviso, we're going to link to the ProPublica Texas Tribune report at democracynow.org. We're going to also do an interview with you in Spanish posted online. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.